I've got very sore toe before we start this. So if I squeal at any point, it's because I've stubbed my toe and it really, really hurts. Hello and welcome to Ecocentrics. I'm Tom.
And I'm TK, and we're on a bit of a mission to live a low carbon life.
But what does living a low carbon life actually mean?
So today we're discussing carbon footprints.
The different types.
The pros, the cons.
And actually, how we can measure our own.
Ooh.
I think you and I have very different perspectives on carbon footprints.
Oh, right. So carbon footprints are essentially, the very definition of it, it's the CO2 released into the atmosphere as a result of a particular individual's activities or an organization or a community. And basically everything could have a carbon footprint. Our products, the headphones I'm talking on right now, our computer, how much food I eat, how much my transport is when I go to the office, my healthcare, et cetera. Tom, any interjections?
I think I would broadly accept that as a definition. I would say, yeah, carbon footprints are a way of understanding the particularly climate impact of almost anything. So you've given the examples of people and products. You can also do like nation states or even like the whole global carbon footprint. So how much carbon dioxide equivalent, which is what we call it, is being released from the whole global community. And that also includes things which aren't people. And I think really importantly, and this is something I want to come back to later on as well, there's lots of variety between how we look at them from an individual to an organization or even a nation state. And there's all these different ways to understand, okay, what is a carbon footprint and what we're measuring it for?
Yeah, it's kind of a complex thing. And if you hear us mention the word CO2e, it's basically the carbon dioxide equivalent, which is sort of taking together all the various greenhouse gas emissions that it takes to produce a product. So there'll be some methane in some of those, some F gases, some other things. So, and we might say GHG sometimes as well. And that means greenhouse gas emissions.
The reason that we have carbon dioxide equivalents as well is because different greenhouse gases have a different impact. Methane have a much bigger impact, around 25 times more impact over 100 years than something like carbon dioxide. And some of the fluorinated gases, so various refrigerant gases, have thousands times more impact than carbon dioxide over 100 years. So that's the kind of reason we put them all into this carbon dioxide equivalent bundle, so we can have a rough idea of what's going on without having to have loads of different things going on at once. To start with, PK, what are your thoughts on the carbon footprint? How do you feel about it?
So I think carbon calculators, some easy carbon calculators, get you thinking about all the things that you do in your life that contribute to carbon footprints. You know, the calculations, there's so much that goes into it. But what I like about the WWF footprint one is that it's fast, it's easy, and it has a lot of tips and it gets you thinking. But I definitely don't think it's the model for everything and how we judge our lives. There's something I was thinking about recently when I was listening to another podcast. There was a particular woman and she gave two scenarios. She gave one scenario of, okay, you've got one person who flies to work every single week. You've got another person who walks to work every single day. But yet the person who's flying every week is a climate scientist flying all around the world trying to solve these problems. Where the person who is walking to work every day works for a major marketing company that produces marketing for fossil fuel products. So here's where the carbon footprints of those two individuals would look very, very different in terms of their lifestyles and their transport. But the carbon climate scientist might be having an overall positive impact, whereas the person who's creating marketing and getting people to buy and participate in a fossil fuels market is having possibly a very negative impact. And so this particular woman, her name is Emma Patti. I think I'm saying that right. It's P-A-T-T-E-E. And she talks about looking at this more like climate shadows. So the shadow is your totality of all your interactions, not just the physical things that have a carbon equivalent that you can footprint, but also the other amorphous things that we can't necessarily always calculate.
Yeah, so it doesn't give you a complete picture of really what's going on. And I think that's really important with this. And Basically, if you go on to into the interweb and look at different carbon footprints for someone the average UK citizen, you'll get so many different answers just because there are so many different ways to look at these things. So for example, you can kind of have a territorial carbon footprint, which is like the carbon footprint of your geography. You can have a consumption-based carbon footprint, which is about all the things you consume. You can have an activity-based carbon footprint, which is all about the activities that you do. You can have a financial-based carbon footprint, which is about the money you spend. And in each one of these things, depending on how you work out your carbon footprint, will give you a very different response for how bad the carbon impact is. So first of all, it's really hard to actually decipher what the number is, but they can also be important to actually help inform. And I think they start a good basis really to start working out your individual impact. However, your individual impact is minuscule, absolutely minuscule. So for example, in the UK, the average per capita, so per person carbon footprint is 7.5 tons a year from government data, which is also, I would say, not necessarily the most accurate way of doing this. And that's a consumption-based government footprint. So for all the stuff we consume, all the random bits I go out and buy and put into my normal life, on average, for an average UK citizen, will be 7.5 tons. But annually, the human species, along with all of the other man-induced consequences, so for example, things like agriculture, deforestation, produces roughly 50 billion tons of carbon dioxide a year. And the vast majority of that comes from energy. So that's kind of about 73% of all of our carbon emissions globally comes from energy. Included within that is transport, about 16%. Energy use in building, about 17%. Energy use in industry, about 24%. And then you've also got other major sectors like cement, which is 3% of all carbon emissions, and then agriculture and livestock being around 6%. So our individual footprint of 7.5 tons is very, very small. And actually, the carbon footprint was wonderfully created by our friends over at British Petroleum as a way to make us think about our own impact and therefore why we should be the people responsible for doing things rather than, that massive fossil fuel company, which is extracting all the oil and gas. So I think the origin story of the carbon footprint doesn't fill me with hope that they are that amazing. And actually, we need a much bigger systemic change to make these things work and reach the really radical emissions reductions required to make our planet hospitable for any future generations and me when I'm 55.
Yeah. And so my individual impact of, say, deciding not to do tourism flying, never using a single-use plastic water bottle, if I went all plant-based, if I never wasted any food, composted everything, global scale, that has a 0.00000 of a minuscule impact. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing these things, but the big changes to draw down emissions are definitely systemic change versus individual change. However, there are times where I kind of look around in my life and I really like to know, well, what can I do? And that's where I sort of go, okay, well, actually, this is my impact. Because I feel like it's us in the Western world who have had the advances of the Industrial Revolution and the advantages that have helped create this problem. And for me to just walk around like, oh, well, it doesn't matter what I do. So I'm just going to fly and buy new clothes and dispose of clothes. And I'm just going to waste and not recycle. And I'm going to waste food, et cetera. I don't know why. I really resist that. Even though I know that possibly my impact is very small, there is a way that I think my impact in doing those things is big and could go to scale. And that is by influencing yet one more person to have some change or to write their MP or to activate or to make a change in their school system. So by lowering my carbon footprint, that means I'm somewhat making it better for other people in some way, shape, or form, even if it's tiny.
Yes, and I'm going to agree with that. I actually think you've made a really good point there, on quite a
Woohoo!
few fronts. I know. And I think the reason why is because the examples you've given are not like classic examples of how to reduce your carbon footprint at the end in particular. But like you talked about things like talking to people, lobbying, campaigning, and like chatting. And I think these are an amazing thing that we all need to do to actually help drive systemic change. However, when you go and do a carbon footprint calculator, it doesn't say, oh yeah, you should go and lobby your MP to make sure that they do something about this, or you should run a campaign and try and take on the system. It says, ah, oh, do you know what? Maybe one less flight is all you need to do, or you need to reduce your meat and dairy, which are good things and they have their own merit and definitely reduce your individual burden, and they more than anything alleviate your own guilt about these things. But actually, it's those things which are a bit less tangible which really need to happen. Chatting to your neighbor about climate change, speaking to your boss and saying, oh yeah, actually I care a lot about this and it's something we should probably do something about. And most of the time when you go and do a carbon footprint calculator, especially a BP one, it won't go and tell you that we need to overhaul the system and chuck them out. It will say, let's think about these little things. And don't get me wrong, I think they're really important. And I've done several of them in my own life. And I say, mainly just to kind of get rid of my own guilt. By having this carbon footprint as our proxy to understand the world, we make people feel like they've got to be perfectionists, and shut down the ideas of people that aren't. And I've had this happening before. Like, I've been out and about, and someone said, oh, you've got a car, you're part of the problem. And yes, I get it. Like, I definitely should reduce the amount I drive, but most of the time I have to drive to work. And by putting the onus on the individual, we blame people rather than seeing this as a real systemic challenge. And it obviously just fits with the narrative of today's world of individualism. You're the agent of your own future. You're in charge of your destiny. When in reality, we all know that's rubbish because, like, overarching power structures are quite important in driving our decision making in general.
You know, I just want to say, Tom, you are perfect. But more importantly, I would really like it noted that Tom said one of the things I said was a good idea.
Moving forward with my berating individual carbon footprints, as I say, I will give at least one line to say that they're good because they are really useful to actually find out things which are bad in terms of your own personal impact. And although that might be small, you can identify some critical areas where you can do things. And like these are usually things just like drive an electric car if you have one, or reduce the amount you're driving, fly less, have a more efficient home, or have a low meat diet. But I also think this gets to my next point, which is a big criticism of them, which it's quite an unjust way of thinking about these things. Normally, people with a lower income will have a smaller carbon footprint because they consume less. And actually, there's also an idea now is that it's rich people who, A, produce most of the emissions. So the top 1% of people are responsible for twice as many emissions as the bottom 50% of all people globally. And middle class and wealthier people now can actually say, oh, we can reduce our carbon footprint because we can afford to go out and buy an electric car, or we can afford to put solar panels on our roof, or we can afford to get the train. This approach to carbon footprinting with these top line things to do often require so much money. They don't really resonate with actually what normal people can necessarily do.
It's a very elitist, wealth-driven ability to be able to make these decisions to lower your carbon footprint. If you're somebody that can say that, then you've probably got a bit more money.
And it's even the case that, like, some people on a lower income might need to increase their carbon footprint, and that's fine. Some people in the UK, in particular, live in fuel poverty. And in reality, they need to be able to use their heating systems more without being berated because their health is also just as important. And I think that's a really important part of this, is it's an easy way to blame people rather than actually saying, oh, no, we should probably think about a nationwide housing scheme to reduce the leakiness of our homes, and actually support people to reduce their energy bills in an effective way.
Yeah, you're absolutely right in terms of not being shamed because you just want to keep a bit warm. You're already wearing lots of layers. You've got two pairs of socks on, and just being able to turn up your heat and not go bankrupt and live comfortably for some people is really can be a real challenge. Yeah.
And I think there's also the risk that we have something called the rebound effect. So the idea of this rebound effect is that once we do something to reduce our carbon footprint can jump back up again afterwards, after the intervention. So there's a direct impact. And this is kind of like when people buy a more fuel efficient car, which is therefore using less fuel and costing you less money, they drive further. They negate all of the positive impact of that efficient car by driving further. And there's studies which show that on average, moving from any sort of average, like normal car to a low emissions car, people drive around roughly 19% further. So actually, you've got this moral high ground saying I've done these things, but in reality, the emissions are very similar. And then there's also kind of like indirect things. So if I start working from home and then that reduces my carbon footprint, what am I going to spend my money on afterwards? So am I going to go and buy flights with that, or am I going to invest it in solar panels? So I think there's a big danger of looking at carbon footprints and having these interventions that actually we have a kind of a net neutral impact. And there's even studies in terms of home heating as well, where after a certain amount of time post a retrofit, so once people have had their walls insulated and their loft insulated, their energy bills are the same and they use the same amount of energy because they get used to a warmer house in general. This isn't every time, but in quite a few cases, this seems to be what's happening. So there's a danger here that, okay, we can make these individual interventions, but without the systemic change, people are just going to have emissions elsewhere as well.
Yeah, it makes complete sense because in terms of exercise, there's a rebound effect. So it makes sense that this would happen in our other behaviors as well. So people will exercise and then they'll think, oh, I can have this piece of cake because I've exercised. You know, energy they've burned is nothing compared to the amount of cake, but then they end up having the opposite effect of actually getting in less better health. So the same thing happens in other areas. So that makes sense that if you think you're doing something good, then we actually increase our activities. That can especially happen when you think you're carbon offsetting, which actually we'll have a whole episode on this, but you think you're carbon offsetting. So you go, oh, that's good. I carbon offset my flight, which is actually meaningless in a lot of cases, et cetera. So you take more flights. You don't feel bad about it.
You explained that in such a nice way compared to the way I explained it. So two compliments in one podcast, a bit much, isn't it?
It's like Christmas.
Like in the aviation industry as well, you have it where like, oh, we've made our planes more efficient, so we use less fuel, and therefore we can charge people less, and people get more flights. So yeah, it happens everywhere. It's a big risk, and there's some issues there. But positively, doing things on your carbon footprint, be that doing things like reducing the amount of flights you take a year, reducing your meat consumption, thinking about things like solar panels on the roof or energy retrofit, as well as doing those like even more important things like speaking to people, can have a major positive impact through what we call social contagion. And this is where people start to see things happening around them and think, oh, fair enough, that's normal. Maybe I should do that as well. Next time you're driving down a street with some solar panels on and you see solar panels, look around, and more than likely you'll see other solar panels around there as well. And that's this process of social contagion, because actually the dial is starting to shift. People are realizing, oh, this is quite a normal thing to do. This isn't some outlandish, crazy thing to do. And you can kind of have these exponential growth curves of the adoption of certain things. Because people are taking individual actions and, most importantly, telling other people they're doing it and making them feel normal about doing those things that are positive for the environment.
The nice thing is, in terms of climate, people do trust scientists and the scientific information, but that comes second to their friends and family. So maybe we won't have this conversation about XYZ because I'm not sure how it'll be received by my friends and family. We actually need to be having these conversations. And honestly, there's so many times I really will start talking to somebody and I think they're going to have an entirely different opinion from me about something. And then we actually agree on a climate-related area. And there's more of us out there than aren't. You know, we should be talking about some of these things. And I'll give you an example. I celebrate Thanksgiving, even though I live here in the UK. And on Thanksgiving, we usually every year like to invite different people who have never experienced Thanksgiving before. So usually every year, except for during lockdown, we have different people for Thanksgiving. And this year we had some friends over and we ask everyone to go around the table and say one thing you're thankful for this year. And we got to this one guy and he actually stunningly, he said, PK, I'm actually thankful for you. Because you've opened my eyes because I post so much about carbon. And he's an amazing person, but he is a private pilot for a millionaire entrepreneur. So he flies a private jet and he's also a helicopter pilot. He's also an amazing dad as well. He's all kinds of things. He's wonderful. But for him to say that to me, he said, I think about things a lot differently than I used to. And that was really, really nice. I never expected that.
PK, what circles do you move in? Each week there's just like, oh, this fancy person here, this fancy person here. It just baffles me every time, these things that come out.
Well, Tom, once you've lived on the planet as long as I have, I guarantee you, you're going to have so many people in your circle. We're at different points. When I was your age, I didn't have these people, but I have met the Dalai Lama. I'm dropping that.
I'll slowly move up to having 5 friends.
This just happened to be a neighbor of mine that moved in during lockdown.
The Dalai Lama?
You should come over, you know? But, you know, I tell you, he is such a trash hound.
So, I wanted to bring up the topic of outsourced carbon emissions as well. With the way that we do our carbon footprints as well, particularly from a kind of government perspective, a lot of the time we think about things which are kind of happening in our on our doorstep, like our local area. And if you were to understand carbon footprints through that lens and that lens alone, you can obviously reduce your carbon emissions to zero relatively quickly by outsourcing all of the things which create carbon overseas. And as we know, in the Midlands, doing that has some pretty major ramifications for local people. And I think there's a danger if we don't consider that full impact of our carbon footprint, that we do something similar again, and we kind of just outsource any sort of work overseas to kind of reduce that impact. And I think there should be a really big call to make sure that when we do use carbon footprints, that we use a consumption-based one to ensure that all of those things are included and it doesn't just kind of get pushed over to someone else to deal with. And in many cases, especially if you're looking about things like production in different countries, like the UK, although it's not a leader in many things, it's bloody good at decarbonizing the electricity grid. And therefore, it's a good place to make things which will be somewhat lower carbon.
So essentially, a lot of the reasons why some of our products are so, so, so super cheap is because we outsource them to other countries. And then, or we import them from other countries is what I should say. So whilst maybe our footprint in the UK for some things and the things we produce may not be maybe lower, we're actually importing. So our consumption behavior needs to be calculated into that. So I was talking to some high school students today. I said to them, look, I haven't heard this from any young people, but I hear it from adults all the time. We're so much better than China and India. And I asked the kids, have you heard this? And they all went, yes, we've all heard that. And I go, what are some problems with that sort of mindset? They said, who are they making these products for? Us. And somebody else said, yeah, and they don't get paid, you know, they don't have fair wages necessarily like we do. So that's why it's so cheap. So that's why you buy this, you know, 2-pound thing. And they went on and on. I go, this is amazing that I got better answers from these 16, 17-year-olds than I do from a lot of adults. And I'm talking about not stupid adults. I'm talking about adults that are smart, that are holding some, you know, pretty good jobs. So I was really impressed with that.
Yeah. And I think it's really important to think about that whole side of things. And I'm going to finish on the thing that I think carbon footprints are really good for, and then we can jump onto actionable points. But the things that I think carbon footprints are really good for are in organizations to understand their impact and therefore take steps as especially big players to start reducing what they're doing, but only if you consider the whole impact of the things you do. So, for example, the wonderful new coal mine, which has been commissioned in Cumbria, you may have heard, is net zero. And the way that they've made it net zero is because the extraction of that coal is done in a carbon neutral way. And it kind of just disregards all of that coal, which I've got a funny feeling is going to get burnt and release carbon dioxide and continue to warm our planet. So I think carbon footprints can be a really useful way for businesses and organizations to understand their impact and actually take some onus on the things that they need to do. But they need to make sure they include all of the emissions they're responsible for, not just the things that they think are easy to deal with.
So what are some actionable steps we can take? You can use a few carbon apps to kind of understand where emissions are coming from. And I would suggest just doing the WWF carbon footprint one because it's fast, it's easy, it has a lot of tips. Again, it's not perfect, but it kind of starts to get you thinking about where your personal habits and behaviors are possibly contributing to emissions. There's also the Geeky app. It's G-I-K-I. I think it's called Geeky Zero Now app. That's another one that you can use. And really, this is just to get you started on understanding emissions in your everyday life. And again, we do need systemic change. But if you can start to make a few changes and start talking to people about the changes you're making, and that, I think, can have a positive impact.
And my action that I think everyone should do is become a fungus, just not athlete's foot. And what I mean by that is think about the webs of life that you're connected to, and the people that you can communicate back and forth with, and actually influence through these things. So it's not just about doing something. It's about, okay, who can I chat to? Who can I have an influence over, in the same way that a fungi can influence a tree? And then spread your spores like a good reproductive fungus, and actually tell everyone about what's happening, and spread that social contagion across other people. If you're doing something, tell people why you're doing it, and don't be afraid to talk about this. Around about 80% of people in the UK believe that the climate is changing, and that something's going wrong here. And especially with things like the heat wave last year, it's clear as day that things are somewhat topsy-turvy across our different ecological and human systems. So people are open for these conversations now, much more than they've ever been. So feel free just to share it with people, and just make people aware. And that's in your personal life, in your work life, when you're chatting to a cat on the street, let them know.
That's right. Don't forget the felines, and be like Tom, a fun guy.
I'm so impressed.
Hey, for an American, that was like a really good pun.
I'm so impressed.
Just in case we have new listeners, this is the quiz time.
So to answer one of the questions that I get asked a lot, what is more carbon intensive? So what do you think has a bigger carbon footprint over its life cycle? Electric vehicle, so an average electric vehicle, or an average internal combustion engine car, so a classic car. You think about like batteries, that sort of thing, like carbon intensive things to make.
Well, I feel like this is a trick question, so I'm going to say the EV.
Wrong! And I'll give you the figures and the breakdown in a second, but it's one of the main things I get like spoken to about when I'm out and about. It's like, oh, but the batteries of the electric car, they make it so bad. And don't get me wrong, there are better solutions to decarbonize our transport system than electric vehicles. So many better solutions. But the electric vehicle across its lifetime produces around about 20 tons of carbon, whereas the regular old car produces around about 42 tons of carbon. And across that, around about 8 tons in the electric vehicle comes from all of the manufacture. So that's the battery, the creating of all the bits and bobs, bring everything together, compared to 6 in a normal car. So actually, the battery does make it more carbon intensive to make the car, but it's only around about 2 tons more. And across the fuel that you're using throughout that time, it's actually so much better.
Okay, Tom.
Okay, PK.
How many times is the average piece of clothing worn by the average UK user before it's discarded, I should say?
I'm not very good with this. I'm not very good at buying new clothes in general. I reckon it's really low. I reckon it's like 8 wears before it gets chucked.
Wow. Like right in dead center, 7 to 10 times. And Tom, you know you wear clothes with holes. I've seen you at work. So in the UK, an average piece of clothing is worn 7 to 10 times before it's chucked. And that is a 30% increase negatively, I should say, in the last 15 years. So 15 years ago, we might have worn it 15 times. But technically, you know, you could wear a piece of clothing 100 times if it's relatively good quality. So you get that point. Cha-ching.
Right. So this one is thinking about things that you can do in your home to not only reduce your carbon footprint, but actually reduce your bills as well. So this is from a study by UCL, thinking about how the interventions you could do to reduce your space heating demand, so the amount of heat you need to warm the house. And we're thinking about here an average mid-terrace house. And I'm going to give you a few options, and I want you to let me know which you think is the most efficient, so the thing that saves you the most energy and the thing that saves you the least energy. So the five options you've got here are loft insulation, floor insulation, moving from a single glaze to a double glaze window, wall insulation, or draft proofing.
I'm going to say the most effective that will save you the most heat is loft insulation. I'm going to do that as the most. And then for the least, I'm going to say draft proofing.
Both incorrect. This one really surprised me as well. I don't think I would have got it. So according to this study, in order from least beneficial to most beneficial, so the least impact first, moving from single to double pane windows is the least effective or has the least impact. Then it's draft proofing, so you weren't far off. Then it's floor insulation, then it's loft insulation, and then wall insulation is actually the major
Oh,
one.
wow. Okay.
According to this study, yeah.
Surprises me. So we spent all this money taking out these single glazed windows and putting in double glaze when really we should have just gone for wall insulation. Great. I won't tell my husband that. So, Tom, if the UK stopped food waste for one day, it would have the same savings of GHG emissions as how many trees?
I'm running through the numbers in my head, see if I can get to it.
So if everyone in the UK for one day didn't have any food waste.
I don't think I can. I feel like it's beyond me. I don't have the mathematical ability to work it out. One small forest, which I'm going to put at roughly 73,000 trees.
It's actually 500,000 trees.
No way!
So we don't have to plant trees. I mean, we can plant trees, but a tree takes about 20 years on average. Instead, we could just stop something we're doing now, and that is food waste. And then it would have the same impact as 500,000 trees.
That's a crazy number. That is absolutely mind-blowing. Like 500,000 trees. Just because sometimes my strawberries go moldy.
Do we have any other business?
We do have any other business. Last week, I spent at least 3 minutes ranting about ESG, environment, social governance, and its lack of merit. Basically, they're metrics that organizations use to score themselves about how good these things are. There is some merit to ESG and there are some benefits. But excitingly, a new report came out last week exploring some of the things that we could do to improve the financial frameworks around net zero. And one of the key areas that will be improved is to ensure that there is better governance of ESG investments. So basically, actually letting people know if these are really good ESG investments or not. And it's only just starting and it's a consultation to work out what's going on. But nonetheless, things are moving in the right direction. And they also want to make an ESG ratings code of conduct as well to kind of show what's good and what's not good and kind of give some people some rules to play within rather than it just being a kind of wild west of, oh yeah, you can say you've got good ESG with the right PR person. I may come back to you in several weeks' time and say, my rant about ESG has been resolved. The UK government has listened to this podcast and said, you know what? Let's fix this problem.
If only let's start addressing some other issues then. Well done. I actually have a funny other business story, and it is related to our last podcast regarding whales. So Tom, I don't know if you knew about this, but at one point, I think it was 1970 in the United States, there's a town, I think it's called Florence, Oregon, where a whale washed up dead. And they were trying to determine how do we get rid of this? Because you can try to haul it back out to sea, but you'd have to, one, it has to not have been decomposed a lot. So you'd have to pull it really far out. Can you do that? That's expensive. Should you hack it up? I know this sounds terrible. Sorry for anybody who's getting queasy about it. But what do you think this council decided to do?
I think I know the answer, and I think I've read about it before. Did they blow it up?
They decided to blow it up. But they actually, it sounds crazy, but it does sound like a very American thing to do. But they actually were thinking, well, if we blow it up, it'll be nice bite-sized chunks for wildlife and seabirds and stuff, which I thought, so it'd be like this massive shoreline of sushi shore. But what ended up happening was it did blow up part of the animal, but most of it remained the same. But massive chunks went, and it went really far distance and hit the spectators, which thought they were far enough away. A table-sized coffee chunk hit a car and demolished it. But everyone survived. But so now, fast forward 50-something years.
My dinner's not looking good right now.
Yes, are you having exploding whale? So 55 years later, there's a town nearby called Eugene, Oregon, and they have a minor league baseball team, a slight step down right below the major leagues. And they're called, I think, the Eugene Greens or the Eugene Emeralds. And they decided for 1 month they are going to change and rebrand themselves to the Eugene Exploding Whales. And they've even rebranded uniforms and even the stadium decor. And the reason they wanted to do this, they said it harkens back to like some of our cultural history, even the absurd, but they really wanted to highlight climate change and the importance of whales and the importance that their migration patterns and other ecology have, and why we need to think about these systems.
That's really wholesome. I thought you were going to say we could just blow them up better next time and get the carbon into space, and then it's not a problem anymore. But you didn't say that. It was very nice instead.
No. So, well done to the Eugene Exploding Whales.
Thanks again for listening to The Ecocentrics. If this episode has helped you fall asleep, don't worry, we've got four more to come, all about carbon footprints and the different environmental impacts of various activities.
So if you want to get in touch with us about the future episodes, you can email us at hello@theecocentrics.com.
Or we're down with the kids and we've got a Facebook page, an Instagram page, and a Twitter page.
And remember to hit follow so you never miss an episode. See you next week.
Bye.
The Ecocentrics is produced by one of the world's coolest parents, Emma Newman.
Theme and quiz music is produced by PK's real husband, Morgan Bryan.
Our research, graphics, marketing, and other shenanigans are undertaken by our enormous team, not